Well, I wasn't sure my subject was going to attract many people. But perhaps you've caught on to the idea behind it. We have probably in the last 60 years there have been a few questions that have recurrently come up. Hundreds of people have asked me a simple question. Why was I born in the first place? That's a good start. From that time on, they get worse. And one friend individual will say, I didn't ask to come here. And if I'm getting along pretty well, I don't ask to leave. But nobody tells me, except that I must do whatever Providence demands. So the individual is not very sure of his place in the plan of things, if he has one. Some feel that they are simply the result of biological progression, that there is no reason for anything in the first place, and therefore that the answer to it all is to quietly get through life as comfortably as possible. Others are a little more dynamic in their thinking. They feel that we should go through life making all the noise we can, that we should be busy every moment and dissipate as far as constitution will permit. Others take some reference in philosophy. They try to understand the reason for life, but they are so unpopular that nobody pays much attention to them. Then the theologian comes along, and he has a very interesting story that was effective until quite recently. In those days when the average person's life was not more than 35 years, or he was able to escape a major dilemma in his community, such as a plague, a fire, or an invasion, these people, under theological pressures, tried to gain a certain patience and insight. They were trying to understand what God wanted them to do and were doing the best they could under the conditions. Theology told them, or explained to them, that the original point behind the whole thing was original sin. Way back in the dawn of times, Adam and Eve were indiscreet, and we have been punished ever since. This has lost favor for the most part, because we no longer will accept this as a reason for thousands of years of assorted existence. Then the philosophers came along, and they made a pretty good story out of it. They said that it was obvious that in this great plan of things, there has to be a reason for what happens. This universe has got some kind of a controlling mind or consciousness behind it. So, philosophy said, we must try and find out what the universe wants us to do. That was never popular, because it seldom, if ever, agreed with what we wanted to do. So philosophy has a small following, and along came science and more or less took care of that. Today, science has become the reason for existence, and also, at the moment, possibly the most likely cause for the end of it. So science became a kind of intellectual hobby. It enabled human beings to find a new outlet, things to do, things to think about, and experiments to make that were wholly fascinating. So gradually, in the course of time, a sort of scientific philosophy came into existence, according to which the real purpose of life was the advancement of knowledge. Well, we have been trying to do that for a long time, and the more we advance, the more our affairs go backwards. So this doesn't seem to be a very good answer. Of course, politics as an answer to anything is virtually impossible. Nobody knows. So we are here in a condition in which we have very few definite supports. And yet we are here. And we are here for an approximate length of time. And time is the measure of opportunity. It is in time that we must succeed or fail. It is in time that we grow or decline. It is in time that the span of our lives can be measured within reasonable accuracy. So we have here a time, now approximately 80 years. This doesn't mean it's a limitation. People can live much longer. But on the general average, that's a fair point. Now, this 80 years seems to be quite a span. In the eyes of nature, the universe, it is about 1 second. And the things that happen in a generation hardly register on the clock of universal events. But we do have this span of time. We have gradually lengthened it. We have made it much more interesting. We have done all kinds of things to use, abuse, misuse time. And yet we have it as a commodity. It really is about the only thing we bring with us as the basis of opportunity for growth, for improvement, or for the development of the individual or collective destinies of mankind. So we all have this time. Now, when we say 80 years, we're not meaning that the individual has 80 years in which to do things. Far from it. Nearly a third of that time has to be used in sleep or rest. Another third of it has to be used to earn a living. And in early life, there's very little achievement. And towards the end of life, there is a weariness which doesn't want to labor too heavily. So out of the 80 years that we have, we are very lucky as individuals if we can call one quarter of that free time. Time to do as we please. But off and on, barring accidents and incidents, we have about 20 years of man-made time in which to do what we were here to do in the first place. Something. We've got to do something with this time. We may want to simply get through it as quickly and as easily and as comfortably as possible. This seems to be the prevailing mode at the moment. Time is a disagreeable period. And the only thing to do to make it endurable is to waste it. And the better we waste it, the shorter life will be, and the longer we will have in which to pass into some oblivion we know not of. So all this brings up the point of today. Here we are with a small span of opportunity. Time to do something. Time to be something. With very little attention as to what we are going to do or what we're going to be. Now, I would say that the majority of young people today, the majority, are so uncertain on this issue that they decide that the only thing to do is to have fun as long as they can. And fun becomes the way of filling up the active quarter of human life that is not occupied by inevitable pursuits. Fun now is all kinds of things. Today, fun is not what it used to be. In the older days, fun was largely a domestic household procedure. The small community made its own entertainments, and between birthday parties and Christmas and holidays and church festivals, the individual got the idea that he was enjoying himself. At least he thought he was doing fairly well. Today, most of these answers are gone. And today, fun is for the most part dissipation. Fun is the individual definitely and desperately trying to forget the reason for himself. And yet he has this self. He cannot explain it, but he knows it's there. He knows that this self in him is alive and is part of a greater life. He breathes, he thinks, he feels. Therefore, there is some part of himself that is in there as a conscious unit, a being. And this being is to the most part an annoyance. This being may have brought forward from the past a certain amount of moral tradition. It may also watch news reports and see what happens to people who abuse being and the trouble they get into. But having watched everyone else get into desperate trouble, the new viewer gets into the same trouble himself without a moment's hesitation. Actually, we are here without motivations, and yet we have opportunity. So one of the things we must admit about life is that for many people, at least, life is a wasted opportunity. There should be something better we can do with it. There should be something about it that we can pass on as an achievement so that our descendants will be glad that they are here and that we have made life better for them. So this problem brings up the great issue that we want to discuss, the proper use of time. And we must admit, I think, the old saying that time is not for wasting. And yet we are doing everything we can to waste it. Our entertainment is a waste of time for the most part. It has been highly philosophized that all these various programs indoctrinate us in great principles and truths and encourage us to avoid ills. But in practice, it does not work that way. We simply sit glued to the tube. And whatever is on there, we take. And we waste the time that we might be doing something with. Now, one of the reasons why we come to this conclusion is that every once in a while, an individual has an opportunity. He has a chance to do something bigger and better than he's ever done before, and he is totally inequipped to do it. He has not any background that is going to support a better level of living or thinking than he now has. He hasn't advanced his studies well enough to claim a better profession. He hasn't a deeper understanding of life with which to build a better home. He hasn't any basic moral integrities to impart to his children. And in the world of politics, he does not know who to vote for, and for the most part, doesn't care. Now, this is not good, and yet it comes about as the inevitable result of an unplanned life. Now, you tell people today, young people especially, that life is something to plan for, and they will do everything they can possibly can to get rid of you. They do not want to plan, because they see or feel that they are surrounded by circumstances that make planning useless. And one of these is nuclear warfare. Many young people today do not expect to fulfill their life expectancy. They believe that somewhere along the line they are just going to be eliminated. Therefore, what they think, what they do, and why become comparatively unimportant. The problem is to live now and make every opportunity to enjoy yourself while you can. This was the motto of the old Romans, eat, sleep, be merry, but tomorrow you may die. This type of thinking has always burdened a world that continued to nurse ignorance and continued to support falsehood. But now in the 20th century, things are getting a little more complicated. There are more people. There are greater problems. There is less integrity. There is more conflict. And every individual sort of feels that his neighbors are his enemies. And the neighboring countries are enemies. And those in office are enemies. And life itself, from the storekeeper to the politician, each is an adversary in itself. So we are here in a world in which most people are not able to cope with the daily circumstances of life. Now, those who are a little older in years have certain inheritance of thoughtfulness. And they are continuing to the best of their ability to make life a little better for themselves and each other. And youth is coming face to face with a major dilemma of its own. It is now becoming increasingly obvious to young people that dissipation is a fatal mistake. That this problem of trying to obscure time, trying to waste time by forgetting you even exist, is not working out. Little by little, a younger generation is destroying itself, or at least disillusioning itself about its own attitudes. So with this type of thinking, we have to realize that an educational process is going on, whether we know it or not, or whether we like it or not, or whether we will accept it or not. Life is not a series of events that have no relationship to each other and no meaning. To attempt to prove that life is meaningless is to gradually transform an interesting and remarkable existence into a state of meaninglessness. It is meaningless simply because we have destroyed the meaning ourselves. So out of this comes a gradual recognition that is taking over very strongly at the present time, that the life of fun, the life of do as you please, the life of give no thought to each other, all this type of thinking is definitely wrong and is producing definitely destructive results. This is the most active and most positive proof that we have that the universe is an integrated being, that the universe has integrities. One of the simple evidences bound through the ages has been that those things which have integrities receive natural support. Those that go against integrities destroy themselves. Nature does not give a victory to that which is not right. It gradually, inevitably, and remorselessly forces the individual, the generation, or the humanity back into line with truth and with fact. Now we're beginning to see this. We're beginning to see the young people we knew a few years ago starting out in life, and we see now that they are wrecks. We see that they have lost all their values, that the moral code is falling apart, and that freedom, as we call it today, is nothing but a travesty. It is the ability of the individual to do nothing, the right that he has to be wrong in every sense of the word. And this is simply not working out. If we could prove that a lawless generation lived better because it lived according to its own inner convictions, it would be different. But the moment the individual breaks away from the basic patterns of society, he is in trouble. And he will remain in trouble until he finally is brought back into line. So we see around us lots of young people today who are badly frightened. Frightened over narcotics. Frightened over many of the mores of modern living. Frightened of dissipation. And afraid of the weaknesses in themselves. The discovery of internal weakness can be a destructive factor, or it can be an inspiration for the individual to mend his ways. So time is the problem we have. This time is limited. This time is something that gives us only a few years in which to do something. Now we know that we have social responsibilities. We know that we have responsibilities to the bodily needs of the flesh in which we dwell. We know that we have to contribute to the support of society. We know that we have to have some kind of income or compensation for effort in order that we can live and eat and have shelter over our heads and educate our children. These are jobs. These are duties. But on account of the civilization we're in, most of the charm of these duties has disappeared. It used to be that many jobs were inspiring. It took something to be a good shoemaker, and when you were a master shoemaker, you were a person of consequence. Now, this type of ability is comparatively lost. It is only in the arts, practically, that any individual initiative is recognized. For the rest, we are expected to become machine operators. We are expected to punch buttons. We are expected to follow the patterns of increasing industrial complexity. And at the same time, we are gradually being displaced. Little by little, we are losing our leadership over the machines that we invent. The reason, of course, is obvious. As we invent the machine, we give up our individuality.
We try to depend upon the machine to think for us, work for us, and labor for us in order that we may do nothing and enjoy it. This isn't working out at all. We are gradually becoming unemployed because we are busy making a profit, creating the instruments that are going to displace us. We are doing everything possible on the ground that idleness is the supreme achievement, that the individual should spend his life having fun. So he's creating machines that take him out of work in order that he may have fun by not working. But fun without work is not very pleasant if you have no way of making a living. So we are just losing common sense. And with the loss of it, we are losing our leadership in the world in which we live. We are not protecting our domains as animals do. We are not taking care of our young as birds do. We are simply doing as little as we can because the intuitive, instinctual part of our own nature has been blocked. And also we find that those things we need to do are least profitable. And profit is measured only in terms of gain or fame. So here we are with this time on our hands. What are we going to do about it? Well, one of the things we have to think of in connection with it is that life is a many-splendored thing. We are not just simply here to punch buttons. We are not here to just simply sit in an office and write torts. We are here for a multitude of purposes. And the leisure time that we buy by constant acceptance of responsibility is a very precious commodity, something that should not be wasted watching rock music or murder films on TV. There are more things to do. The individual has a self within him to bring out. He has capacities he's not even interested in developing. And yet within himself, he today carries the greatest potential of any living creature on the earth. Man has the power to be that which he is willing to accept the responsibility for. But he wants no responsibility. He wants to do as he pleases. He wants not to work, but to spend. And to keep on spending without keeping on earning comes to a bad end. It is the same in almost everything we do. We are flattered into extravagance. We are wasting constantly what we cannot afford. And we are living beyond our means in the majority of instances simply because we do not care about a future. We do not care about a world we're going to leave behind sometime. If we leave it behind, let it take care of itself. Perhaps some of our ancestors said that, and that's why we're in so much trouble. But regardless of how you look at it, these years that we have, these hours a day, maybe 2 or 3 hours a day, are available for something better than wasting, something better than trying to bury our boredom, something that is more valuable to us than trying to forget that we do have a life and hoping that by forgetting and taking our mind away from facts that we can drift slowly into oblivion with a bridge card in one hand. This is the type of thing that we want to try to do. Many older people now are just trying to fill up time. They have no real initiatives, no values. And yet they have within them the most powerful force in the whole world, the human spirit. What is happening to it? It gets tired. It gets tired largely because it doesn't have any resources. If it really understands itself, it won't be tired. But if it understands nothing but a job, it will be tired. If it recognizes that as long as it can breathe, it can learn, life would be far more interesting. But we gradually overlook all this and largely are over-influencing our own feebleness of age. With nothing to live for, there's very little for the body to do to help us. If, however, we keep on calling on resource, the body will continue to provide it. Maybe not completely, but enough to give us a very interesting and purposeful existence. So in this particular problem, it's a matter of finding out that we will live longer and better if we're doing something we believe in. If we're making some kind of an effort to help others, to advance the cause of good projects, if we are definitely engaged in meaningful activity that satisfies the mind, the heart, and the hand, we will have a much better chance of health. There's nothing that is more likely to produce a very serious health relapse than a life devoted to escaping responsibility. The more we escape, the more we compromise, the more we dissipate, the more likely it is that we will practically die on our feet because we have nothing left to live for. Now, if we have some time, it's a good point to start in as early as we can to figure out how to use these potentials that we have. And I think the old guild system in Europe was one of the best that we know. And the guild system was a very carefully developed process based upon the Dionysian artifices of ancient Greece. The guild system was the basis of education. The education was what we would term today by apprenticeship. The individual learned by doing. He learned to be a shoemaker by apprenticing himself to a shoemaker. And for 5 or 10 years, he stayed with his master, the shoemaker, until the master gave him his papers by which he became a full-fledged shoemaker in his own right. And having attained to this particular distinction, he had a career for life. He was also bound by the system to the integrity of his labor. Every pair of shoes he made was part of a guild structure, and a cheap pair of shoes was a disgrace to every shoemaker that ever lived. And when it happened, the disgracing one lost his papers. He could not shoddy his goods. He could not overcharge. He could not misrepresent, or he would be out of business. Now, we have unions today. What might not be a bad idea to include a little bit of this in the modern thinking of union, that the union worker is part of a structure of labor, a laboring structure to provide the necessities of life. Any member of a union who cheats, defaults, overcharges, exaggerates, or fails to fulfill in the best way possible the job he has is a disgrace to his union. And in the 16th and 17th century, that disgrace came as a very rapid punishment. So the union produced, those unions in those days produced these workmen who were trained, who were dedicated, and to whom a good day's work was part of a basic religion and was sanctioned on the point as to whether there is a God or not. It is a good religion to do a good, honest day's work. Now, this type of thinking has kind of disappeared, but the guilds had another interesting point. When you were a member of the guilds, you didn't just go on all the time doing nothing but shoemaking. You had a complete pattern of life in there. And these guilds, all of them, functioned on a level of creative art. A good guildsman was probably a musical composer. He made shoes in the daytime and wrote poetry at night. He not only did that, but he had competitions in music in the local church or cathedral. He had all kinds of artistic achievements. He was a composer. He was a literary man. He did everything you could think of. Perhaps he was a tailor in the daytime, but at night he painted portraits. Every guildsman had to have two strings on his bow. He had to have two things to do. One, to make a living for himself and his family, and the other, to make a living for the being inside of himself that wanted to do something important. So these people We know probably one of the best examples of this is the story of the Meistersingers of Nuremberg in the opera of Richard Wagner. Here Hans Sachs is the hero, a shoemaker, who was also a politician, was an artist, a musician, had his apprentices and taught them as a parent, not as a taskmaster. He wasn't there to get the last ounce of life out of his apprentices. He was there to see that when they came and got their papers, that they would be a credit to the guild, a credit to the trade they belonged to, and also that they would share in the avocational developments appropriate to a good workman. A good shoemaker cannot make shoes 24 hours a day, even if he could stay awake. A good man in any line, a tailor, a grocer, a mechanic, they cannot do nothing but that without destroying the inner part of their own lives. Therefore, everyone who has a trade should have an art. Everyone who has a craft should work towards a profession. Everyone who is working works for three things: the good of society, the advancement of human needs and his own life, and the glory of God. Those were the principles upon which labor was originally based. Today, such thoughts are little better than treason. We have lost all of this. We have lost it and have now made it a virtue to think of only one thing, and that's your job, and stay on it till you wear it out, and then someone else will take your place. This is not humanity. This is the result of a loss of the realization of the human dignity of every human being, that we are all here for mutual support. In the course of society, it has become necessary for us to all cooperate to maintain the common good. In one way or another, we all have to help each other, whether we like it or not. But in the making of this type of a decision, we need dreams, we need hopes, we need visions, we need something in the inner life of the individual that makes it needful and proper for him to grow as a person. He must not only be a good carpenter, but a good father. He has not only to work to maintain the physical existence of his family, but to see that it grows, is educated, and if necessary, to sacrifice much of himself for the burdens which he has voluntarily assumed. But if he is proper-minded, these experiences are all valuable. He may learn a trade, but if he fails to hold his home together, something is wrong with his integration. So now we come to this top problem of time. These hours that we have to ourselves are the opportunity for our cultural development. They are the period and time in which we can do the things that we want to do. But everything depends upon our wanting to do something that is worthy of a human being. It doesn't have to be a great and masterful achievement, but it has to be something that is a step ahead of the monotony of labor. It has to give some contribution to the involving and evolving of life. When the old guild masters built a house, it was more than just a roof and a basement and four walls. A house had to have something about it that was beautiful. It had to be timbered on the outside, sometimes in Europe painted with interesting designs, religious or secular. A place made beautiful. No one was satisfied simply with four walls and a floor. They wanted something that pleased the inner life of themselves, something pleasant, something inspiring, something comforting. And the same when they furnished it. They were not buying furniture on the basis of finding out who could afford the biggest chiffonier or something. They bought the things they liked. And having liked them and bought them, they loved them for the rest of their lives. The process of dumping the house and finishing it every 3 months does not occur as an example of taste. It is another one of these desperate, nervous reflexes to boredom. the individual has to do something, so the easiest thing for him to do is spend money, if he has it. And if he has it and can spend money, then he has the yacht and the condominium and all these things. But he is still bored. And these things do not constitute growth. They do not make a better person. And the purpose of time is to make it a part of growth. It is our growing time. And up at the present time, it has been largely a growing pain. We have not recognized the magnificent opportunity to do something that we can be proud of. It is no use trying to be proud of the fact that we are more eccentric than somebody else, or that we are in worse taste than our neighbor, or that we make more noise than anyone else in the community. These are not the tests. The tests are that we have proved conclusively that we are making use of potential. The human being has over 40 faculties within that skull of his, any one of which can develop an art or a science. He has all kinds of potentials waiting for something to do with them. A few, by working very hard in their fields, become specialists to the degree that they are musicians or artists or great architects or highly gifted and recognized scientific thinkers. They have done a great deal with themselves to gain this kind of reputation. And we all have the opportunity to spread out into the fields of emotional maturity. Our emotional lives are going to pieces also. There is no longer very much integrity in them. Emotion at the present time is simply a quick reflex to escape boredom. It is anything that the moment it becomes monotonous, it is broken up. There is no real effort to build these things as positive equations in life. We accept them as just another way of wasting time until we die. So out of all this time wasting, we are becoming a world of alcoholics, drug addicts, and what have you. The entire theory of life has fallen apart. Now, fortunately, in the midst of all of this, the prodding of inner conscience has begun to move things a little bit. More and more people every day have come to the conclusion that delirium tremens is not an achievement. Are they also beginning to realize that a series of divorces is not the symbol of a successful marriage? And also that children becoming minor delinquents are not proof that we're doing things well in the home. Little by little, we are beginning to realize something that we wanted to forget, and that is there are rules in here somewhere. There are rules that created us in the first place. They are rules that are magnificent in their potential. The rules far beyond anything that we can achieve or hope to achieve. We cannot keep the stars in their courses. We cannot prevent the changes of seasons. We cannot make any great variation in the laws of nature. But we don't need to. Most of these laws are working eternally for a purpose. And in these laws there is an integrity, even when the laws do not please us. If a law doesn't seem to please us, then we are inclined to change the law rather than ourselves. Now, if it's a man-made law, we can change it with a reasonable amount of discretion. But a divine law, we cannot change. In the case of a divine law, it intends to change us and will do so at all cost. So in a universe in which man is trying to take over the divine prerogatives, but has never been able to control himself, there is a need for a new attitude toward time. The only chance we have to learn how to live in this world is to live in this world. The only way we can find out the better things of this world, the only way is to cultivate those better things, to become aware of them, become interested in them, become dynamically involved in them. Now we look around and into the present situation. Which way do we turn? Well, a great many people are turning to religion. And if the selection is carefully made and thoughtfully fulfilled, it can be a very great help. Because religion will remind us of one thing, namely, that there is a moral universe, and we are a citizen of that as well as the physical world. This moral universe of integrities is known to all the religions of mankind, and we gradually come to realize that if we break too many of the commandments of religion, we destroy our civilization and ourselves. We'd like to escape this. When we read it says in the Decalogue, "Thou shalt not kill," we pause for a moment, but many people will say, "Well, that was written long ago. We can't follow that now. It's just not possible." And so we ignore it. Go to church, teach religion to our children, and declare war on another country. We just don't seem to realize it. Then in the name of the war, if we patriotically serve our country, then we are heroes. Not because we have prevented a war, but because we have, in our best integrities that we know, we have given of ourselves as much as we can. But the problem is not solved this way. The problem is solved only when we get to the point where we don't break these laws in the first place, where we are not likely to get into these difficulties, personally or collectively. We are warned that we should not covet, and yet 90% of people covet and go to church regularly. It doesn't occur to them that there's any inconsistency. Thou shalt not bear false witness. If that was enforced, half the law courts of the world would close. Honor thy father and thy mother. Yes. Many try to do it very desperately, but it's becoming more and more of a problem, because not only are the children keyed to a different pattern, but the elder themselves don't want the old way of doing things. So little by little, the morality and ethics of life are undermined. And then in this undermining, there comes a gradual disillusionment. Nothing is worthwhile. As one man told me one day, he said, "There's so few of us get out of this world alive." The answer is, as far as we know, there was only one, and we killed him. Simply because we will not face facts. So this world is something that we have to give a little thought to. And in order to give a thought to it, we generally have to get the mind off of something that has hypnotized it for generations, or at least for most of our lifetimes. It's very hard to tell a scientist that he should take time off of his laboratory, because he lives there, thinks there, and believes in it and what he's doing. The individual with a good job is ready to die for the job. He is not interested in diversifying. He wants to get further and further into what he has in the hopes it'll result in him having more. So he keeps on until retirement blocks him. And when retirement blocks him, he's completely at loose ends because he has no other life. It's not right to do this with a thing we call a human being. There must be something better that can be accomplished if we really want to do it. So the second string on the bow, as the old Gills tell us, could be a great help. If the individual who is in business became profoundly interested in the moral values of art, so that he could combine both of these factors. And very often this happens in exceptional cases where a person has had extremely powerful internal initiatives. The great millionaire ends up by building a museum for art, or he gives a great donation to a cathedral, or he does something for a great charity, because somewhere inside himself, he can't live with himself any longer. And he finally has to get rid of some of the pressures, undefined pressures of conscience, which will not let him forget the fact that he's a member of the human family. So we have all kinds of instances in which very powerful and useful accomplishments come. Now, many people are interested in good accomplishments, But then again, the dominant attitude of accomplishment is that it must be physical.